This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Democrats in the Senate surprised even themselves yesterday. They got just enough votes to hang on to a timetable for a U.S. troop withdrawal from Iraq, part of any latest emergency bill that would fund military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Senate deadline, March 31st, 2008, is non-binding. The promised presidential veto would be. It's another busy week in politics. On top of the Iraq vote, a staffer for Blue Dog Democrat Senator Jim Webb is arrested for taking a loaded gun to the Capitol. He says it's the senator's. The senator neither confirms nor denies. The attorney general hangs on as one of his key aides takes the fifth and another one gets set to testify tomorrow. And as always, there's plenty of news about the race for the presidential nominations in 08. We figure it's about time for another giant-sized edition of the Political Junkie.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
But I'm the decider.
We'll talk with our resident junkie in just a moment. And later in the hour, a doctor takes your questions on the recent study that found that heart patients may not need angioplasties and stents. Drug treatment and healthy living prevent heart attacks just as well for many patients. But first, our Wednesday visit with the political junkie. Is the vote on a timetable for Iraq just political theater? What does it mean for the president, for Democrats and Republicans? And would Democrats vote against a military funding measure if it does not include a timeline? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And let's bring resident political junkie Ken Rudin into the conversation. Ken's with us here in Studio 3A as usual. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Neil.
This vote in the Senate comes after the House passed its own version of a timetable for withdrawal last week. It brings us another step closer to a showdown with the White House. Again today, President Bush said he would not accept any bill that includes a deadline for withdrawal.
And I have made it clear for weeks, if either version comes to my desk, I'm going to veto it.
President Bush speaking earlier today at the National Cattlemen's Association meeting here in Washington, D.C. Ken, where does this leave everything right now? Of course, that one thing to begin with, I guess that vote yesterday in the Senate, it's still preliminary.
Right. Yesterday's vote was a 50-48 defeat on a Republican amendment that would strip language talking about a date certain, a non-binding date certain for a timetable to pull out. But the question you asked earlier, would Democrats vote against the bill if it included, if it didn't include a timetable? The same question could be asked of Republicans. Would Republicans vote against a bill that included basically the funding for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So both parties are on tenterhooks about what to do because they have tremendous policy implications as well as political implications.
And there is a certain class of Republicans, people who want to put their position down as opposing the war but don't want to endorse a date certain.
Exactly. And that's why I think that's why you only saw two Republicans really break from the Republican ranks yesterday's vote. It was Chuck Hagel of Nebraska. It was Gordon Smith of Oregon. Both are up for re-election next year. Chuck Hagel's probably safe in Nebraska, maybe less so for Gordon Smith in Oregon. But and two Democrats, Mark Pryor of Arkansas and a nominal Democrat, Joe Lieberman, a Democratic independent of Connecticut, voted with the Republicans. So we talk about how unpopular this war is and how much anger there is around the country about the war. And yet, for the most part, both votes, the vote in the House last week and the Senate yesterday, were pretty close.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see if we can get another voice into the conversation. Joining us now is Senator Richard Shelby, Republican from Alabama. He was co-sponsor of the Cochran Amendment in the Senate yesterday that would have removed language about a troop withdrawal. Senator Shelby joins us from a studio at the Capitol. It's very nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And what was the meaning of yesterday's vote as far as you're concerned?
Well, I thought it had some meaning. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been voting the way we did. It was a close vote, but it's not the end of the day. I think it had substantive meaning because it had that timeline in it that we've all been discussing.
Mm-hmm.
What will happen now with the House and the Senate conference and ultimately when it comes back, we don't know.
When it comes back, you mean after the president vetoes it?
That's right. We don't know what's going to happen.
So this risks the prospect of the president says he needs this passed within a matter of just a few weeks or else funding is going to run out to pay for operations in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, I think what most of us are trying to do is make sure that the troops are funded. And that's very important. And I believe that putting a timeline on the beginning of withdrawal is the wrong message at the wrong time. It's an ambiguous message because we have said we're not going to do this 2 weeks ago. Now we're saying, yes, we are going to put a timeline. And we're saying we support you, but we don't have confidence in you. We don't think you can succeed. And that's a wrong message. I think that we all realize that we're in a quandary. In Iraq. We don't know what's going to happen there, but General Petraeus, who a lot of us have a lot of confidence in as the new commander, personally met with a lot of us, and I was very impressed. Mm-hmm. And he says basically to us that he needs some time, and I believe that he is making progress on the margin as we speak. 7-8 months from now, say Labor Day or a little after, we will know for sure, and so will the president. But I believe we ought to give our troops every chance in the world to succeed. That is, to bring stability to the area, and then perhaps we can have the diplomats to get involved, maybe find some political resolution to the area, because none of us want to stay in Iraq forever.
Mm-hmm. Success or even progress is an elusive thing.
Progress, yes. Yeah. How do you define success? You know, we don't want to stay there. We do want to bring stability. We do want them to be able to have a strong police force and an army. But the Iraqis themselves now are going to have to step up. They're going to have to accelerate what they're doing.
Senator,
if they don't, then we'll know. But 120 days, 4 months, is clearly not enough time.
There are some signs of progress already in Baghdad, yet just a year ago, people were saying the situation in Tal Afar, a city in the northwestern part of Iraq near the Syrian border, that's the model that we should be following. Yet just today, we find reports of 50 Shiite policemen in Tal Afar going around and shooting Sunni residents, that this is as bad as ever.
Well, it's a tough neighborhood. We all know the history of Iraq. How it was created. We know the ethnic and religious divisions there, and a lot of those things aren't going to be settled by us in 6 months or 60 years. But if we can bring some stability, we have a lot at stake here, and I think we should give our troops and General Petraeus, our commander, every opportunity to succeed.
Senator, not to deal in hypotheticals, but if we have to hear, assume the president does veto this bill that comes to his desk, and let's assume that the Democrats still insist on a date certain to withdraw, and they will not fund the war without this date certain, how do Republicans vote against it, if that's what the language is going to be, if majorities in both the House and Senate call for that timetable?
Well, I think we'll reach that bridge when we get there, but at the same time, I believe that the president means what he says, that he's going to veto it. Because if he didn't, after saying all this thing, all the things he said, nobody would believe him anymore. Mm-hmm. But I believe he will veto it, and I believe we will sustain the veto. And after that, we start negotiating. And I think that puts the Republicans in a stronger position than we are today.
See if we can get a caller in on the conversation. By the way, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Matt's on the line with us from Chicago.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Senator Shelby didn't give the argument, but a couple Republican senators gave the argument yesterday that this bill, by setting a timeline, sends a signal to the insurgents to wait us out, that there's now all of a sudden a date in the future to wait us out, and then from there, then they can start their attacks anew.
No. I was just,
No, not Senator Shelby, but I know Senator McCain said that yesterday. Isn't that exactly what we're hoping for, to give the Iraqi army some breathing?
I can't possibly say that, but I could say earlier this week a new study found that a healthy lifestyle and drug treatment
we're having some technical
problems
with getting some signal from some other place. I'm sorry, Matt, your question got interrupted.
Oh, sorry about that. Senator McCain yesterday and some other senators had said that this, it sends a signal if we have this date in the future. It sends a signal that the insurgents can just wait us out. They can wait a year or 4 months or however long it is, go into hiding, and then come back once we're gone.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't that the whole point of our training, is that we're training the Iraqis to take control on their own? And if the insurgents go into hiding, that's great. Isn't that the most optimal outcome, that we, they get a year, scot-free? The insurgents, they think that they're going to outsmart us and wait us out, but in effect, it's the perfect scenario for our trainers to go over there and help the Iraqi army and police force.
Let's give Senator Shelby a chance to respond.
Well, I don't think we should put any deadline on anything dealing with war, and this is what we're dealing with. We'll know how we're doing on this surge by Labor Day. That's not far off. That's 6 months. And by Thanksgiving, we shouldn't have any doubts as to how we're doing. We owe that to them. In the meantime, we're sending a signal to the Iraqi government that you've got to build up your own army. You're going to have to control your own country. You're going to have to do your own battles because we're not planning to stay there forever.
Thanks very much for the call, Matt. Senator Shelby, if come September, October, November, Thanksgiving, things are not working out the way people would hope that they would, and General Petraeus is hoping that they will, and we all hope they will, at that point, what's plan B?
Well, I think we have to wait and see what happens. I'm hoping, and I think a lot of us are, that General Petraeus, his new leadership, his new attitude, his new tactics will work and bring some stability. But as you just raised the point, if say by Thanksgiving, if we're where we are today, then we're all going to have to reassess this thing and say, my gosh, you know, we tried. But until then, let's put everything in it we can. There's nothing like success.
Senator Shelby, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
We appreciate you joining us. Richard Shelby, Republican of Alabama, speaking with us from a studio up on Capitol Hill. Ken Rudin is here. We have a special expanded edition of the Political Junkie, given the votes in Congress these past couple of weeks on funding for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Both houses of Congress have now passed measures that include deadlines for withdrawal, not binding in the Senate. It would be binding in the House. We're going to have to wait and see when a final vote is taken in the Senate, then reconciliation with the House bill, and what happens if the president vetoes the bill. When we come back from a short break, we'll be speaking with Congressman Jim Cooper, a Democrat from Tennessee, about his difficulties with all of these decisions. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. One day after the Senate voted its support for a troop withdrawal deadline, we're talking about the politics of the war in Iraq and what the recent votes in the House of Representatives and the Senate mean for the president and for both political parties. This is a supersized edition of the Political Junkie. Of course, Ken Rudin is with us here in Studio 3A. And you're welcome to join us if you have questions about the politics of the war, about the rest of the political news this week, the Attorney General, the campaign for 2008, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. On the line with us now is Representative Jim Cooper, a Democrat from Tennessee, a member of the Blue Dog Coalition, a group of generally more conservative Democrats in the House and Senate. He's with us by phone from his office here in the Capitol. Nice to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be with you.
And we just heard Senator Shelby argue against any sort of a public timetable. You voted in favor of a House bill that included a firm deadline for withdrawal. Why?
Well, I actually agree with Senator Shelby. It would have been better if we didn't have a public timetable in the bill, but I was willing to go along with the House effort. I think it does put pressure on the Maliki government in Iraq to shape up. They have many shortcomings. It also sends a message to the president that he needs a series of strategy changes. Bob Gates is certainly an improvement over Donald Rumsfeld, but we've got a lot more work to do. General Petraeus is a great general, but our entire Middle East strategy has been flawed.
And so if the president vetoes the bill, what happens then?
Well, you know, the president's threatened hundreds of vetoes in the last 6 years, and he's only delivered one on stem cell research. So there are many skeptics as to whether he'll follow through on this threat. Already talks have begun, now that the Senate's passed their non-binding deadline, about exactly what should be in a bill. My prediction has been all along that we'll end up with a much cleaner supplemental than we voted on so far, because I think whether it's Senate conferees or the president, a lot of the extra stuff on the bill will be stripped out.
What the president describes as pork, a president and a lot of other people.
A lot of it was legitimate emergency money, but it was bad optics to have it as part of a war supplemental. So I think that, you know, those issues will be handled.
Was part of the reason you supported this measure to support your leader, Nancy Pelosi?
That was part of the reason, but the main reason was to support our troops. We've got to get this money passed, and within a month, we can't dilly-dally around. Not every congressman could get his or her own first choice on these bills. We've got to get something passed because our troops are literally running out of money.
What happens again? The president, let's say the president does veto it, hypothetically, and then says, look, we've got to get we're going to run out of money for funding the war in Iraq and Afghanistan in a couple of weeks unless I get a bill on my desk, and I'm not going to approve one that has a date for withdrawal.
Well, the president has the whip hand in this debate because no one thinks we could override a presidential veto. And Democrats need to realize what slender majorities we have in both houses. We lost 14 Democrats on this vote in the House, and it only passed 218 to 212. In the Senate, it passed with the help of Republican Senator Chuck Hagel with a slender one- or two-vote majority. So we do not have the majorities we need to set U.S. foreign policy, and the Congress is institutionally incapable of setting effective foreign policy because we're a committee of 535 people.
Congressman, I was struck by the 14 Democrats who voted against the bill last week. Half of them were from the far left of the party, basically, who felt that the war should not be funded at all, and others were from conservatives who felt that there should be no timetable. Is the party united on this war?
I think it was a remarkable achievement for Nancy to get 218 votes because both the left and the right wings of the party are upset about various parts of this bill. I think the vote is a testament to the fact she found the political center of the party. Nancy is a very adept politician. She's a remarkable leader, and she's had a great 3 months as the first female speaker in American history. But these are very tough issues. I think if you have a historical perspective, you'll see that we're behaving much better than the Republican majority did when Clinton was president and we were involved in Bosnia. And it's much, much better than it was in the late days of the Vietnam War. So we're trying to pressure the president in appropriate and fair ways. He is showing signs of listening. Look at his reversal in North Korean policy and his change in Iranian and Syrian policy. So I think we're making progress. It's not always easy or pretty, but I think we're making progress.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Richard. He's calling from Tennessee. I'm not sure if he's in the 5th District or not, but Richard, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Question for you. If it's such a good idea, I support the idea of moving a bill through that will support the troops. I stand behind them myself. But if it's going to be a problem and a president's going to veto something that he doesn't like in there, why couldn't the Congress pull out the withdrawal terms and simply vote for a censure, which hasn't ever been done in probably the last 100 years or so for a president?
Censure the president?
Yes.
Congressman, is that on the table?
It's not on the table right now, nor is impeachment. I think most people want to see a strong U.S. president. Many people are disappointed with President Bush's various failures, but it doesn't help America to have these internal censure movements. I think we've got to move forward, support our troops, and let's do the best we can to have successful foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Richard. How do you respond? People say, you know, look at the opinion polls. We Democrats were elected last November by people who wanted to change in policy in Iraq. You look at the opinion polls, a substantial majority of people say it's time to set a deadline for withdrawal.
But the Constitution is something we swear to uphold, and the founders gave us a process that is cumbersome, has checks and balances. Not everyone gets his or her way, but it's been pretty darn successful over the last 230 years. Our challenge is to make the constitutional structure work in this case and in all cases, and I think it's working.
Let's talk with Robert. Robert's with us on the line from Novato in California.
Yeah, I was just going to ask the question, Ken Rudin, before, is that how can we not put in a timeline if we expect to ever get out of here? Because this, we've already lost the war. If you read enough, you have to assume that. There is no coalition. There's just the United States paying the whole way. And no one wants us there. So what is the purpose of this other than something they're not telling us that they're there for? It's not for our standing in the world, that's for sure.
Congressman?
I think the caller is being unduly negative. There's certainly been a lot of bad news, but there are many Iraqis who not only want us in the country to stabilize the situation, they're desperate for our help. Read the New York article last week, The Betrayed, by George Packer. We owe an obligation to the folks who have supported us, and we've got to honor that obligation. Parts of Iraq are doing very well. The Kurdish area is remarkably stable and calm. There are other signs of hope, and we just can't, unless we want to become isolationists, give up on the rest of the world. I would certainly agree with the caller. Our opinion, our standing in the world is much lower than it's been in probably in American history, and there are a lot of reasons for that. I'm hopeful that we're starting to correct some of those reasons, because most people do not blame the American people for these problems. They might blame particular leaders that we have, but most folks have generally good feelings toward the average American.
Hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Robert. I think you were listening earlier when Senator Shelby said, look, let's give it till September, October, Thanksgiving. If by Thanksgiving it's not working, it's time to really reconsider. Is that basically something that you would agree with?
I think he's right, and he's largely quoting General Petraeus, who's considered to be the best commander we've had in Iraq during the entire conflict, which, of course, has lasted already longer than World War II. The trouble is the administration doesn't have a plan B, as you mentioned. Their plan B is to make plan A work. And if plan A doesn't work, I think we're probably going to end up looking at something like soft partition of the country, because people seem to be moving that way themselves, with as many 2 to 4 million refugees already in the country as people leave the mixed neighborhoods and go into safer havens.
And at that point, what's our obligation to those people you mentioned George Packer wrote about, to the betrayed?
Well, that's something we're going to have to sort out as a nation. It's my understanding that some Scandinavian countries are already welcoming Iraqi translators with open arms, the folks who helped our troops and our civilian officials maneuver around the country in the early days of the conflict. Many people have risked their lives and risked everything to help the U.S. in Iraq, and we have an obligation to those people.
Congressman, thanks very much. We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Neil. Very
Bye-bye.
Kind.
Now, that was Jim Cooper, a Blue Dog Democrat from the 5th District of Tennessee, joining us by phone from his office on Capitol Hill. And as we were hearing, Ken, this is not an easy vote for anybody in the Congress, I don't think.
No, and I'm wondering, I was really pretty much struck by what Senator Shelby said earlier. The fact is that he, a strong supporter of the war, would be willing to consider perhaps taking back some of that support if by September, October, Thanksgiving, it didn't work out. And I'm just wondering if there may be some move after the president vetoes this bill, if the Democrats might say, okay, we'll give you the funding for the war, we'll pull down our timetable, but if by September, October, it's not working, one, I assume that that language would return to the bill, and two, I would assume that far more Republicans would support it than they do now.
And those Republicans that we were mentioning earlier, people who are a little uncomfortable with this, or even more uncomfortable than Senator Shelby, people like Norm Coleman in Minnesota, the two Republican senators from the state of Maine, even John Tenuno in New Hampshire. There's a bunch of Republicans who are facing difficult re-election battles and in states where they could look at the polls and see how many people are opposed to the war.
This war is very, very unpopular, and you will see people like Susan Collins, Norm Coleman, John Tenuno, as you said, perhaps even John Warner of Virginia, those who may face very, very tough races in 2008 and see if their votes change on the war.
Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, there was other political news this week in Washington, D.C. Let's not forget about the ongoing United States scandal surrounding the Attorney General. Kyle Sampson, the former chief of staff to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, testifies tomorrow. And, of course, Monica Goodling, an aide to Gonzalez, has already said that she, if called to testify, will plead the Fifth Amendment.
Monica Goodling apparently is a liaison between the Justice Department and the White House regarding the firings or the dismissals of these eight U.S. attorneys. What's amazing to me about this is that this is a scandal that probably didn't have to be. I mean, again, we've said this over and over again. The White House has the right to terminate these U.S. attorneys. They, quote, serve at the pleasure of the president. Now, the fact that these U.S. attorneys may be involved in key delegate political investigations, if that's the reason they were let go. Obviously, that's why there were hearings. Mm-hmm. But Gonzalez, it seems like he changes his mind every day. There's a new story why these attorneys have been dismissed. First, he had nothing to do with it. Then emails show that he did have some conversations about this. And you know, he's scheduled to testify before on Capitol Hill on April 17th. The guess in Washington is that he may not be Attorney General by April 17th.
Mm-hmm. The president continues, though, to vote his full support for the Attorney General.
As he did for Donald Rumsfeld prior to letting him go right after the election of 2006.
Looking ahead to 2008 and the political campaigns for the presidential nominations, obviously the big news within the past week since we spoke to you revolved around John Edwards and, of course, the news that his wife, Elizabeth, her cancer had recurred, and their decision to continue on with the campaign. We spoke about that at some substantial length earlier this week on the program. But nevertheless, this has really changed things, the dynamics on the presidential side.
It has. I mean, of course, the caucuses, the Iowa kicks it off 10 months from now. I mean, January 14th. So who knows what this means for John Edwards? And I hate to talk about Elizabeth Edwards' health as a political concern, but the fact is that John Edwards' support has increased. More and more people have opened up their checkbooks to John Edwards, and I don't know if it's a sympathy vote. John Edwards clearly said he does not want anybody to vote for him because of what's going on with Elizabeth, but it still looks like a three-candidate race. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards seems to be leading the pack, both in polls and money. We'll see. The 31st of this month is the deadline, the quarterly deadline for raising money. It'll be interesting to see what candidates are in the top tier and what candidates have really not raised enough money to be competitive.
Ken Rudin, our political editor, the author of the Political Junkie column, which you can read at our website, npr.org, and the Political Junkie here with us every Wednesday on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And speaking of the top three, you just named the top three on the Democratic side. Top three on the Republican side, at least according to one new poll, has an interesting new name.
Well, that's true. And, you know, we've talked to Congressman Jim Cooper. We were talking about, of course, Jim Cooper and his vote on Iraq. But Jim Cooper also was the Democratic nominee in 1994 for a Senate seat won by a guy named Fred Thompson. Fred Thompson, who has not given any indication that he's serious about running for president. But a few weeks ago, he said, well, I would consider it. And he went from not even an asterisk to in the latest Gallup, USA Today, CNN Gallup poll, he's like third place with 12%, which lets me know, one, that the Republican Party is seriously looking for a new candidate. They have reservations about the ostensible three frontrunners, Rudy Giuliani, Mitt Romney, John McCain, and maybe it's just the flavor of the week, the flavor of the day, but Fred Thompson could be that guy, conservative. His bona fides on conservatism are not questioned, and he's a kind of a Reagan-esque kind of character who might be the kind of candidate you want.
And there are also some other developments. First candidate to withdraw from the race, Tom Vilsack, the former governor of Iowa, hoped to get the Democratic nomination. And a couple of weeks later, he decided he wasn't going to get the Democratic nomination. And he's come out with an endorsement.
That's right. He endorsed Hillary Clinton. And we know how endorsements are very, very important in Iowa. We know that Tom Harkin in 2004 endorsed Howard Dean, and Howard Dean finished third in the Iowa caucuses. So, I mean, it's nice. Hillary Clinton got a nice endorsement. She may have worked out some kind of a deal where she could help retire his campaign debt. But ultimately, I don't think endorsements mean that much.
Mm-hmm. She also got more money in her Hollywood fundraiser than Barack Obama got in his Hollywood fundraiser. So
she apparently is raising a ton of money. You don't see many of these candidates campaigning because the name of the game right now is making headlines with the amount of money they're raising. And apparently Hillary is doing very, very well raising money.
Let me ask you also about an unfortunate situation, as Senator Jim Webb described it. He, of course, got elected last November to the United States Senate based on the gaffes, principally, of his opponent, who will forget the macaca moment. Nevertheless, earlier this week, one of Senator Webb's aides was caught trying to enter the United States Capitol with a loaded gun in his briefcase.
This was very bizarre, a very close and trusted aide. Apparently, according to this aide, according to what he told authorities, that he dropped off Senator Webb at the airport. Senator Webb gave him this gun, and I guess he forgot about it, and put it through the x-ray machine at the Capitol. But Jim Webb had a very bizarre press conference yesterday. He said, no, I did not give him the gun. And he spent most of the press conference not answering questions. It seemed like a very odd way to introduce himself to the national audience. But Jim Webb, obviously, there are a lot of questions about what happens. Ultimately, I don't know if it's a big deal, but Webb seemed very tight, very, very out of sorts watching him try to explain something that he didn't fully explain yesterday.
And finally, last week you mentioned Kathleen Blanco, the governor of Louisiana, deciding not to run for re-election. Democrats hopeful that the former Senator Jim Breaux would run for that seat. John Breaux, excuse me. Now there's a question. Is John Breaux a citizen of Louisiana?
Well, according to the state constitution, you have to. The only way you could run for governor is that you have to be a citizen of the state, quote, for at least the preceding 5 years. When John Breaux left the Senate after 2004, he became a lobbyist in Washington at Patton and Boggs. He lives in Maryland. He owns a car registered in Maryland. And Republicans are trying to say that he cannot run. He cannot legally be a candidate in Louisiana because he is a resident of Maryland. This will ultimately go to the courts in Louisiana, but obviously the Republicans know that John Breaux would be a very strong candidate.
Ken Rudin, thanks very much. We appreciate it. Ken Rudin, our political junkie here with us in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, your questions about stents, drugs, and heart disease. A new study found that a healthy lifestyle and drug treatment could be just as good at preventing heart attacks and death as angioplasty and the insertion of stents. If you have questions about that, we're going to have one of the leading heart surgeons in the country with us. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.